South Korea is launching its first astronaut in April, Ko San. No word yet on what music he'll bring along, but Ko San will be taking the spicy flavor of his homeland to the bleak interstellar void. He takes off for the International Space Station in April with a supply of the Korean delicacy kimchi, specially engineered for consumption by Korean astronauts. Now, to make kimchi, you ferment cabbage with red peppers and lots of ginger and garlic. Many Koreans swear by its health-saving properties. They even say it can protect you against SARS, maybe because no one will come near you if you have kimchi on your breath. But unfortunately, the fermentation process involves lactic acid bacteria, and space food must be sterile to protect astronauts' health. So scientists at Korea's Atomic Energy Research Institute have developed a special germ-free kimchi by zapping it with radiation. According to the Korean newspaper, Chosun Ilbo, taste testers say the space kimchi has zest and makes them feel almost as good as the terrestrial kind.
Residents of New York City have a reputation, not really deserved, for being rude. The classic example is the New York City waiter who ignores you or insults you or doesn't want to serve you lunch. Turns out this is an old habit in New York. According to our science correspondent Robert Krolwich, it's been going on for 10 million years.
So here I am, right in front of Saks Fifth Avenue in New York City with my friend the biologist Guy Robinson. We are not shopping. We are looking at trees.
If you look up now, if you look into the branches up here, you'll see some sprouting out of the branches.
He is talking about thorns, big, spiky, sharp-looking thorns high up on the trees in front of Rockefeller Center, right on Fifth Avenue. Local shoppers can just look up.
Yeah, I see them.
Yes, I do. I see them there.
And if you touch one, ow, oh, it's really...
it's very nasty. You wouldn't want to walk into one of these.
But if you were Professor Robinson, you would ask...
Why are there all these spikes here?
Trees typically produce thorns to repel something, but what could possibly be bothering this tree?
It's protecting itself against what?
Cab drivers.
Not cab drivers, but it is a puzzle, really.
Because there's nothing around here that it's effectively defending itself against.
So what scientists do in a situation like this is they can ask, is there any other tree anywhere in the world that produces a thorn that looks just like this? And it turns out, there is.
Acacias, which you find in Africa.
Acacia trees have the same size and the same shaped thorns. And why?
Well, in Africa, they seem to be protecting themselves against elephants.
In Africa, elephants like to lunch on acacia fruit, and then for dessert, they often peel and eat the bark.
Bark's very nutritious.
But it's not, of course, good for the tree, because without bark, an acacia tree will die. So over millions of years, they have evolved thorns to poke at elephant tongues.
You wouldn't want to lick that tree.
Oh, no.
So what are you saying? If acacia trees developed thorns to fight elephants, then the New York trees did the same thing in Manhattan? Because I'm standing here across from St. Patrick's Cathedral. I just don't feel elephant in this vicinity.
Not now.
But 11,000 years ago, there were elephants in Manhattan. We call them...
mastodons.
And says Carl Buell, who draws ancient animals, mastodons were kind of hairy and very big.
8 foot at the shoulder, maybe for a female, 10 for a male.
Whoa.
This is a big animal.
And they lived in New York?
Oh, yes. We found mastodon remains and bones literally all over New York State.
But when I said to shoppers outside Saks Fifth Avenue, here's a picture of what these thorns are fighting against...
Against a mammoth.
Yeah. You don't believe me?
No.
But they should. Mastodons and this species of honey locust have been neighbors for millions of years.
Oh, yes.
So it is totally possible these trees were once attacked by local mastodons. And even though there hasn't been a mastodon in Manhattan for 11,000 years, the thorns stayed.
It took millions of years for it to happen, and it'll probably take a couple hundred thousand at least to get to the point where a honey locust said, well, I don't need these thorns anymore.
To be fair, there is no direct evidence that mastodons actually ate these trees.
Well, we need to look at mastodon dung to know that.
Because if there's honey locust fruit in mastodon dung, then you know they ate these trees. And guess what? Professor Robinson happens to have a fossilized sample.
Yeah, there's this great big bolus, which to us could only have been...
You can say it.
Poop. Yeah.
But he hasn't checked his sample, not yet. So, for the moment, this is still a hypothesis. It's not proven. But what a notion. So for 11,000 years, these trees have been getting ready for the mastodon that never comes?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
they're like waiting for Godot, and it's sort of sad.
It kind of is. They seem a little lonely.
Standing there on 49th Street, on 50th Street, thorns ready, but no mastodons. Robert Krulwich, NPR News, in New York.
If you can't get enough of Robert Krulwich, we can solve that problem for you. You can download his podcast, Krulwich on Science, at npr.org/podcasts. Some employees of Starbucks might conclude that this is the time to go back to college. The coffee chain is ordering a grande double shot layoff latte with whip. As the baristas would say, it's cutting 600 jobs. Starbucks is struggling with a weak economy and tough competition, and in the future it could face another challenge. And that brings us to our last word in business, coffee robot. Italian scientists this week unveiled a robot barista named Justine. She's part of a European project to develop robots that can use two arms together, because apparently many current robots can only handle one-armed tasks. But Justine still needs work. At the moment, she only makes instant. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. If you want to trace some ways that childhood has been changing, you could go back to a single afternoon in October of 1955. That's the day when kids across America sat in front of the television and heard this.
Who's the leader of the truck that's made for you and me? M-I-C-K-E-Y.
Something during that TV program signaled a shift in the way children would be spending their playtime. And some experts say that shift in turn has altered children's imaginations, even the way their minds develop. Today in Your Health, NPR's Elise Spiegel explains what happened on the screen that day.
It was during the first episode of the Mickey Mouse Club that the Mattel Toy Company introduced a new product, a toy gun that the company claimed had almost magical properties.
It's broken the sound barrier. It's the Mattel Thunderburp with the real vibrasonic sound chamber that's loaded forever and ever. No batteries, no caps. That Thunderburp looks like real, sounds like real.
Historian Howard Chudikoff says that until that October afternoon, no toy company had ever tried to sell merchandise on television year-round. The only time toy manufacturers advertised on TV was during Christmas. But then came Mattel and the burp gun, and according to Chudikoff, a professor at Brown University who recently wrote a history of child's play, almost overnight, children's play became focused, as never before, on the toy itself.
It's interesting to me that when we talk about play today, the first thing that comes to mind are toys. Whereas when I would think of play in the 19th century, I would think of activity rather than an object.
You see, for most of human history, what children did when children played was engage in freewheeling imaginative play, elaborate narratives of pirates and princesses. Basically, they spent most of their time doing what looked like nothing much at all.
They improvised play, whether it was in the outdoors, the fields and the forests, or whether it was on a street corner or somebody's backyard. They improvised their own play. They regulated their play. They made up their own rules.
But Chudikoff argues, once TV and toys begin to supply children with ever more specific scripts and special props for their stories, the size of children's imaginative space begins to shrink. And that's not the only way that imagination comes under siege, according to Chudikoff. In the second half of the 20th century, he says, parents were increasingly concerned about safety, which again affected play.
Because then adults want to structure it more, to create environments that are safe, that are secure, that cannot be penetrated from threats from the outside world.
To protect their children, parents begin to place their kids in adult-moderated activities, which, says Chudikoff, has another benefit, especially to middle-class parents worried about achievement. They promise enrichment.
You know, karate classes and gymnastics, summer camps, not only create safe environments for children, but also give them enriched lives and ways to create self-esteem.
So clearly, the way that most children spend their time has changed. And of course, there have been other changes in the lives of kids. But a growing number of psychologists believe that these changes in how children play have led to changes in their cognitive and emotional development. Here's some of the evidence. Back in the late 1940s, some psychological researchers did a series of tests on children. In one of the tests, they asked kids ages 3, 5, and 7 to stand perfectly still without moving. The 3-year-olds couldn't do this exercise at all. The 5-year-olds could do it for about 3 minutes. And the 7-year-olds could stand pretty much as long as the researchers asked. In 2001, some researchers actually repeated this experiment. But as psychologist Elena Bodrova explains, the results were very different.
Today's 5-year-olds were acting at the level of 3-year-olds 60 years ago, and today 7-year-olds were barely approaching the level of 5-year-olds 60 years ago. So the results were very sad.
Sad because the children were less able to do something called self-regulation. Self-regulation is the ability to control emotions and behavior. It's a key component of a broader set of skills called executive function. Kids with good self-regulation aren't impulsive, they have self-control, discipline, and this self-regulation is incredibly important. In fact, good self-regulation is a better predictor of success in school than a child's IQ.
Self-regulation predicts effective development in virtually every domain.
This is executive function researcher Laura Burke of Illinois State University. She says make-believe is a powerful tool for building self-regulation. That's because during make-believe, children engage in what's called private speech. They talk to themselves about what they are going to do and how they are going to do it, laying out the rules of play for themselves.
We find that this self-regulating language is highest during make-believe play. And this type of self-regulating language, which we call private speech, has been shown in many studies to be predictive of executive functions.
Basically, it's through this private speech that children control and regulate themselves. In fact, private speech is how adults control and regulate themselves, too.
If we look at our own use of private speech, what we find is that we're often using it to surmount obstacles, to master cognitive and social skills, and to manage our emotion.
Unfortunately, the more structured the play, the more children's private speech declines. Essentially, what's happening is that because children's play is so focused on lessons and leagues, and because kids' toys increasingly inhibit imaginative play, kids aren't getting a chance to practice policing themselves. When they have that opportunity, the results are clear. Self-regulation improves.
One index that researchers, including myself, have used to look at that is the extent to which a child, for example, cleans up independently after a free choice period in preschool. We find that children who are most effective at complex make-believe play take on that responsibility with greater willingness and even will assist others in doing so without teacher prompting.
Despite evidence of the benefits of imaginative play, a number of child development experts say free choice play is in decline even in preschool. Here's psychological researcher Dorothy Singer of Yale.
Because of the testing and the emphasis now that you have to really pass these tests, teachers are starting earlier and earlier to drill the kids in their basic fundamentals so that play is viewed as unnecessary, a waste of time. I mean, I have so many articles that have documented the shortening of free play for children where the teachers in these schools are using the time for cognitive skills.
Singer and others argue that it's not actually helpful to leave imaginative play behind. They say that all that wasted time is really not such a waste after all. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Now, if you have questions for the experts on how your child can build self-discipline, email them to us through our website, npr.org/yourhealth. Next week, we'll post answers to some of those questions and look at a preschool program specifically designed to teach 4-year-olds executive function skills.
Middle-aged women in the U.S. are heavier on average than they were a decade ago, and that is making them more prone to stroke. That's the conclusion of new research reported at this week's International Stroke Conference in New Orleans. Researchers compared two studies, one conducted from 1988 to 1994 and another begun 5 years later. In each, several thousand women answered questions about whether they had ever been diagnosed as having a stroke. Dr. Amitus Tofighi reported the findings at the New Orleans conference.
What we found is that the stroke prevalence in women age 35 to 54 in the previous study was 0.6%. And in the more recent study from 1999 to 2004 was 1.8%. So the stroke prevalence had actually tripled in a decade, whereas in men, the stroke prevalence had remained stable.
And is it clear to you, you were also looking at women's weight gain, in particular in belly fat. Is it clear to you that those two things are related? In other words, as middle-aged women have put on weight, especially around their middle, that that seems to be correlated with this tripling in the prevalence of stroke?
Well, the interesting thing about our study is that we found that other traditional risk factors for stroke, such as diabetes and high blood pressure, had not changed significantly over the years. And the two things that had changed significantly were waist circumference and body mass index, which is a measure of obesity. In general, women aged 35 to 54 had increased waist circumference by about 4 centimeters and increasing body mass index. In previous studies, these factors have been associated with stroke risk.
4 centimeters is how many inches?
Almost 2 inches.
So the increased stroke risk could be independent of higher blood pressure, independent of a higher incidence of diabetes. It could be purely related to weight gain and to body fat?
Absolutely. We controlled for all those other factors, including diabetes, cholesterol, high blood pressure, and found that the one thing that was driving this increase in stroke risk was the waist circumference and body mass index.
Dr. Tofighi, were you surprised when you looked at these numbers and realized not only had there been a tripling among women in the prevalence of stroke, but that women actually had, I think it's about double the incidence of stroke that men did in this age group of middle-aged people?
Yeah, this was really surprising to us because for men in this age group, their stroke prevalence has remained stable, whereas women's has increased significantly. So now women are at much higher stroke risk than men in this age group. And this goes against everything that we've traditionally been taught in general. In the midlife age group, we think that men are at higher risk than women, and then women catch up after menopause, but it looks like things have changed in recent years.
Was it the women who were technically obese who had the highest risk of stroke? I mean, does a very moderate weight gain seem to have any effect?
So in this study, we found that even if you're not obese, but you're overweight, that will still increase your risk of stroke.
Dr. Tofighi, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Amitus Tofighi is an assistant professor of neurology at the University of Southern California. She spoke to us from the International Stroke Conference in New Orleans.
Dan Ariely conducts great experiments. They involve mock auctions, trick-or-treating on Halloween, selling chocolate to college students on campus. Ariely is on the faculty at MIT. He's on leave teaching at Duke. He is a behavioral economist. Dan Ariely tries to answer the question, how do we make economic decisions? And here's his conclusion. We don't do it the way economists typically say we do. We are predictably irrational. That's the title of his book. Here's one of his concerns. How do we come to attach a value, a price that we're willing to pay, for a piece of candy?
Think about a piece of chocolate. It's melting in your mouth. You feel it. You smell it. You taste it. There's a little nut inside. In standard economic lingo, you should have a reservation price. You should have the maximum willingness to pay for this particular experience. But if you reflect on it and you say, how do I actually do it? How do I take this experience and translate it into money? You would realize that it's in fact a very hard exercise, and it's completely unclear how we map pleasure onto money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking of this piece of chocolate, if it's inside the minibar of a hotel room in a multi-star hotel for the fancy European label, I might be willing to pay a lot more than something at the office that's standing on a counter.
And the experience will not be very different itself. It's just that our willingness to pay, it turns out, is not just a function of the utility, of the pleasure that we expect to get from it. It's also influenced by all kinds of irrelevant factors that change our psychology but not our economic reasoning.
Now, I'd like you to relate the actual field work, the experiments that you've done on, I guess, somewhat unwitting MIT students with the price of chocolate.
So we came to a big class of students, and we asked them all to give us their last 2 digits of their social security number. So in my case, it will be 79. And then we asked them to write that number next to each of the products. There were wine bottles, there were computer parts, there were books, there were chocolates. So I would write $79 next to each of those. And after that, we asked them to write whether they would pay that number. So whether they would pay, in my case, $79 for each of those products, and they wrote yes or no. And then we got to the crux of the experiment, in which we asked them to bid in an auction on each of those items, any price that they would. And everybody bidded. We found out who was the highest winner. They got up, they paid their price, and they got their product. But then what we did was to calculate the relationship between people's social security numbers and their willingness to pay in the auction. Now, this sounds like a very strange idea. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fact that they have made a decision about their social security number. They said, would I pay $79 for this thing, yes or no? And the question was, would this initial decision penetrate their next decision? And the answer was very much so. And in fact, the correlation between their social security numbers and how much they were paying for the product ended up being at about 0.5.
That the lower the person's social security number, the last two digits, the lower the price they'd be willing to bid.
That's right. But it's not the fact that people with high social security are prone to pay a lot of money for everything in their lives. It's the fact that they contemplated that number. I mean, we could have made them contemplate all kinds of things. We could have made it contemplate the weather, the shoe size, whatever it was. But once they contemplated something, when they came to the next decision, the first contemplation lasted and influences their later decisions as well.
Because you've made me think about a number in my head, the last two digits of my social security number, and relate it to things, it remains a benchmark in my mind.
That's right. So in my case, I would think, yes, I said $79 was too much for this wine. How much is okay? Well, maybe 65. But I stayed too close to that number.
Now, you also have an experiment in which you illustrate the remarkable power of giving away things for free where the price is zero.
Yes. The interesting thing is that many times free things are good. But the question is, what happens when free actually has a downside? What happens that to get a free cone of ice cream, you have to stand 2 hours in line? Are people going to overvalue free and be willing to do too much for it and, in fact, end up paying too much? So we did a large set of experiments. Maybe the most cute one is one in which kids who came on Halloween to my house one day, and I first gave them all 3 Hershey Kisses. And I asked them to keep their hand open and to keep the 3 Hershey Kisses outside, not in the bag. And then I gave them another option. I said, here I have 2 Snickers bar, a small Snickers bar and a large Snickers bar. And I will give you one of those and only one of those, but here's the deal. If you want the small one, give me 1 Hershey Kiss. If you want the big one, give me 2 Hershey Kisses.
You just gave them the Hershey Kisses before this.
That's right. So I knew they had them. And now they had to decide, basically, was it worthwhile giving me an extra Hershey Kiss for the bigger one compared to the small one? And virtually everybody saw that this was a fantastic deal. You know, just chocolate per chocolate, they got 8 times their investment for getting the large Hershey Kiss. But here is the other thing that I gave to another set of kids. I discounted both Snickers bar by the same amounts. I said you could have the small one for free, or you could get the big one for 1 Hershey Kiss. Now, the relationship was the same. They should have still asked themselves, is it worthwhile to give an extra Hershey Kiss to get the big one? And in fact, it was still a tremendous deal. But in this case, the kids went largely for the free one, basically giving up a better deal, a fantastic deal, just because of the allure of free. And by the way, this is not just with kids. We replicated experiments with Amazon gift certificates and products and chocolates with MIT students and adults. And everybody has the same issue, that free is such a hot button that many times it tempts us so much that we end up paying a high price or give up something better just for the allure of free.
By the way, did you happen to catch any of the conversations between the trick-or-treating kids and their parents as they left your front door on that Halloween?
So many of the parents were very concerned.
I'm not surprised, yes.
You know, some of them would let the kid walk alone so the kids feel a little bit independent. But as I started the offer, they would get closer and closer, checking out that I'm not doing anything fishy with their kids. The kids actually took it very well. They're used to trading chocolates at Halloween and so on. But the parents were curious, and many of them remained and asked me questions about it.
Well, just one last question before I let you go, which is, if indeed we are as irrational as you would have us, does behavioral economics pretty well make a mess of regular economics and say that can't be describing human behavior since it's not the way we behave.
That's right. So behavioral economics flies in the face of standard economics in two ways. One is we say your model of human being is wrong. And the second and more important thing is saying, as a consequence of this, your prescription for policy is also wrong. And that's actually the most important part of this. If you understand the places where people are irrational and make mistakes, you need to think differently about policies for healthcare, for saving, for driving, for smoking, for anything you want that is different from the one that standard economic prescribes.
Well, Dan Ariely, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dan Ariely's book is called Predictably Irrational. In the introduction, he writes about the time in his life when he became intrigued by these questions, 3 years as a patient in an Israeli burn unit. You can hear that story at our website, npr.org.